dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence brief on what I think of as the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to have with us as our first guest in this program a man who is in the front lines of that war. Quite literally has been in the front lines in uniform. He is a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army Reserves, a medical doctor, is being served a tour as a combat doctor in Iraq. Today he is a member of the United States House of Representatives representing the people of Ohio too, and a member of the Armed Services Committee and Veterans Affairs Committees. In short, a man of exceptional capability, and we're very pleased to welcome Congressman Brad Winstrup. Thank you so much for joining us, Congressman. Welcome, and thank you for your service to our country, sir.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be with you today.
Among your various services, we have seen, I think, the results of mistake made after you served in Iraq, namely withdrawing lock, stock, and barrel from the country. The possibility of it playing out again is very real in Afghanistan. You've just returned from Afghanistan. Give us a sense, if you would, of your impressions from that trip and where you think that leaves us.
Well, first of all, let me comment on Iraq because I think it's a very sad situation, what's happened there, and certainly we don't want to repeat that in Afghanistan, as you alluded to it. When I look at Iraq and I think of the bloodshed there and the fact that we liberated 26 million people and now they're back in a more vulnerable state, and I know that certainly, besides many of the civilians, the majority of the civilians in Iraq that would have liked us to still be there, the Kurds certainly would have loved for us to still be there because we've kept them safe since 91. And now we're in this situation with Afghanistan where we're at a crossroads once again. And part of the delay right now is, of course, with President Karzai unwilling to sign a bilateral security agreement and the new front runners to be president, both say that they will. They're pro-Western, which is to our benefit. And they said that they will sign a bilateral security agreement. The question comes in with this administration is what will that look like?
And to the extent that there's been some concern about how long it will take to get that thing signed and so on, were the personnel that you met there, the military personnel there, reasonably confident that they could make the necessary arrangements to keep in place some number of forces if they don't get the formal go-ahead until Karzai leaves office later this year? And what kinds of numbers were they suggesting to you, Congressman Winstrup, should we retain there in order to both protect them in the first instance and be useful in this transitional period?
Yeah, well, there's a combination of not only protecting them, but protecting those that we do have behind. And I do think that there's a sense among the Afghan military and among the Afghan population that we need to have an American presence there to some degree. From the generals on the ground, General Joe Dunford, he has said publicly that less than 10,000 troops would make our mission untenable. And I would tend to agree with that. They feel that their army would maybe be able to hold off the Taliban by themselves for maybe 12 to 18 months. I don't know if I would even give it that long. It really is important that we're there. We do not have to be on the front lines per se, but we want to be able to provide intelligence. We want to be able to help with support and supply, maintenance, health care, all those aspects that they really are not capable of providing for themselves if they're to be successful. And I think the new president's presidential candidates recognize that and will go that line. Now, you talk about a time frame, and that does make it difficult. And I think that we just have to continue to plan as though we are going to be there, and I hope that we plan that it's at least 10,000 because the 5,000 number will be too small. Well, and let me run this by you, too. Taliban's not stupid. The Taliban is not stupid, and so we just had a successful election by and large, very few interchanges with the Taliban. And so everyone's excited about that. And then there'll be the runoff election in June. And Taliban may lay down through that, too, because I think that in back of their minds, they're thinking if this all looks like it's going fine, more Americans will leave. And that may be setting us up for a bigger.
There's no question in your mind, though, Congressman Brad Winstrup, then we're looking at an undefeated Taliban, a Taliban with the ambition to return to control over most of, if not all of, Afghanistan. And presumably with that, a willingness once again to extend safe haven to other Islamists, including al-Qaeda. Of course, we went there in the first place to try to prevent that from happening. This is a distinct possibility as you see it, and presumably is part of why you would argue, as you do, that you know we can't take this for granted, that it'll all come out right if we're out of there or in there in inadequate numbers.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I don't think the Taliban is defeated. You summed that up correctly. And also they have support in Pakistan, which is another part of the equation that we have to be concerned with. So, you know, the new president's got this dilemma in front of him to provide security for his country and in many ways wants to have some type of peace effort with the Taliban. So clearly they're not going away. Well, I don't think that they can really negotiate well with the Taliban if they are not strong and they do not have the security forces. So it's imperative on their ability to negotiate something like that for them to be strong, and that includes us being there in good numbers. We need a counterterrorism mission, we need a training mission, and we need a mission to defend ourselves.
That goes to the rules of engagement, and I think we'll all be watching closely what turns out in terms of whatever latitude our guys are given to assure their own safety as well as their effectiveness in the country if they are allowed to stay by the administration as well as by the Afghans. Congressman Brad Winstrup, one of the things that you are continuing to do as a member of the U.S. Army Reserves, of course, is serve during your reserve tours as a surgeon out at Walter Reed. And first of all, again, I want to thank you for that important continuing contribution to our men and women in uniform. Talk, if you would, quickly about the condition of the troops coming home from these long and considerable degree thankless wars.
You know, one of the things that I see firsthand is that their attitude is tremendous. They're strong. But this is an environment where they are still with their band of brothers, if you will. When I see amputees fighting to go up steps with their prosthetics for the first time, and they're sweating, and they're just saying, I'm not going to quit. I can do this. And their attitudes are so tremendous and all the things that they want to accomplish. The difficult time comes when they go home. You know, when you leave that community, when you leave your band of brothers, if you will, I think that's when it becomes mentally more tough, physically more tough, and you can feel a little bit isolated and more problems tend to stem. I mean, if you just look at the suicide numbers, a couple interesting things associated with that, but most of them are occurring out of uniform, not while they're still in uniform. Another interesting thing we heard at a hearing last year is that numbers in the civilian are just as high. And it's in the same age range, 23 to 29, and predominantly males. So this may not just be a military issue, but more of a society issue. I think that deserves more attention.
It does indeed. Speaking of more attention, you will be beginning in the House Armed Services Committee, on which you serve, Congressman Winstrup, as soon as, I guess, tomorrow, the markup, as they call it, of the annual defense authorization bill. You serve on the Tactical Land and Air Forces subcommittee as well as the Military Personnel subcommittee there. Are we doing enough? Do you expect the Congress to do enough to address what I'm hearing now ceaselessly is the hollowing out of our military by the Obama administration and, you know, the effects of the sequestration bill in Congress. How does that look to you at this point?
Well, there's certainly a lot of controversy about what our military is going to look like. And what I have a problem with, and I think you'd appreciate this, is we're building our strategy based on a budget rather than our budget based on a strategy. We really need to know what our strategy within the world is, and then let our military leaders decide what that takes to reach that point. Instead, we're going in the opposite direction.
This is a case of the strategy not only being absent, but a kind of threat-based strategy at that being absent as well. And I couldn't agree with you more. I hope that you will find, as you begin working through the annual authorization bill, an opportunity to remedy that situation or at least minimize the kind of damage that's being done, but will translate into future losses, casualties and killed in action, and probably those of us here on the home front if nature takes its course. Again, Congressman Brad Winstrup, thank you, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army Reserves, medical doctor, for the myriad ways in which you're contributing to our country. And we hope you'll keep it up and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. We'll be talking next with Henry Now about Ukraine and NATO right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors,
dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families, retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Well, Welcome back. We're joined by Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the George Washington University's Elliott School, Dr. Henry Now. He is a man who served with distinction on President Reagan's National Security Council. He is the author, most recently, of Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. It's always good to have him with us. Henry, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what a conservative internationalist would do about this Ukraine business. Vladimir Putin persists in ramping up, it seems, the pressure and perhaps is spoiling for a fight there. You've urged that NATO act sooner rather than later. Talk a little bit about how you see this conflict unfolding and what you would specifically would recommend we do now.
Right. Well, conservative internationalism advocates, Frank, using a little force early in order to avoid using a lot more force later. So in some sense, had we acted 2 or 3 years ago and used just a little bit of force to reassure Ukraine, we might have avoided both Crimea and what's taking place now in eastern Ukraine. Today, it's very difficult for us to do much other than to support the Kiev government. I would like to see us provide some more substantial military support, but we're behind the curve in Ukraine. My recent newspaper article suggested that we move now in the NATO countries that are next on Mr. Putin's list, and that we use a little bit of force now to station NATO troops in Poland, in Romania, in the Baltic states, so that when he, in a couple of years, when he moves against those countries, he will face a different calculus.
If it's a couple of years, indeed. And just very quickly to calibrate here, Henry, now, a little bit of force seems to be what President Obama has talked about. He's got 150 troops that he is stationed in these various countries or is engaging in exercises. I assume you've got something more than that in mind.
No, I think absolutely. I mean, we've now landed some 82nd Airborne troops in Poland. I mean, I think we should land a couple of thousand. We should position a couple of thousand troops.
We're visiting with Dr. Henry Now. He is the author of Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan, and a professor at the Elliott School of George Washington University. And Henry, in terms of calibrating this properly, obviously part of this is a function of do we understand what we're up against? John Kerry, the Secretary of State, testified the other day before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and made it sound as though, once again, it's just really a problem that Putin doesn't understand the ways of the world, that he's not operating in the 21st century. You're a professor of these matters and understand them deeply. What do you make of that kind of comment by our Secretary of State?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, I mean, it's sad to say, but I wonder if Secretary Kerry isn't the one who's out of touch with reality. I mean, Russia is playing the same game that has always been played in international affairs, and it is still being played today. That is, he is taking advantage of weakness in order to expand his influence. He would like to reestablish that former Soviet sphere of influence. And we need to play the game of balancing power, that is, of making it clear to him that it's going to cost him if he moves in this direction and eventually deter him from doing this. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't continue to do a lot of other things that are more 21st century. I think we should be offering the Russians all kinds of opportunities to participate productively in the global economy. They need foreign investment. So we should hold that out as a carrot. But at the same time, we have to be very clear about limiting any kind of territorial expansion, which is as real today, by the way, as in the 19th century. We can see that in the Far East as well with China.
Indeed, and that's perhaps a subject for another day's conversation. But just staying with the present one, and again, we're speaking with Dr. Henry Now, who wrote recently at dw.de, NATO should act now, not later. Let me ask you, Henry, now, as a former international economic affairs, sort of official in the National Security Council under President Reagan, what you make of the concern that is being expressed by some that Putin may respond to the ratcheting up of these sanctions. I gather this is now the fourth round in sort of small increments that have implicated more and more of his cronies and some of the companies they're associated with. But what about the prospect that he may retaliate by accelerating his own effort to take down the dollar as the reserve currency? Should we be concerned about that, and what should we be doing about it?
I don't think so, because he will take down his own economy if he does that. And this is the same issue, you know, that we face with China. Yes, both Russia and China could start selling their dollar reserves, foreign exchange reserves, but if they do that, it means that they're going to be able to export less oil in the case of Russia, or less goods in the case of China. I mean, this is a bargain that has worked very well for all sides, and I don't think they'll do that. Now, they'll potentially threaten to do that, or at least make us worry about doing that. I think we should, you know, continue to tighten the sanctions, but more importantly, we should make some military moves. This is what Mr. Putin will understand. If we station some troops now, NATO troops permanently, I think we should set up some NATO bases in some of these bordering countries. We by the way, agreed not to do that in 1997 in order to appease the Russians. Well, they've now violated that agreement, and we should make it clear to them that we intend to put, you know, small, I mean, 2,000, 2,500 small forces, but they're going to be permanently based there. That will affect his thinking, I think, a lot more than the, as you say, very incremental sanctions that we've been imposing against some of his cronies.
Yeah, so much of this, it seems to me, Henry, now requires the authority of military capability behind whatever diplomacy we're engaged in. And you've made the point in your article about the very substantial buildup that Putin has engaged in recent years, increasing by 79% over the past decade, his military spending, and an almost 50% increase expected in the next 3 years. Talk a little bit about how the failure on our side to be doing that not only impinges upon our ability to put forces in places like this that we need, but to really back it up with the credible threat behind it.
He has been expanding his power base and principally on the strength, of course, of high oil prices. On that basis, however, he's been expanding both the economic activity in Russia. They've had reasonable economic growth over recent years. And, of course, he's been funding this massive buildup in military capabilities. Now, he's taking a page from Ronald Reagan, who in the early 80s, you know, built up dramatically the economic and military foundations of American foreign policy. And that had a tremendous influence over our ability to eventually bring an end to the Cold War. Now, I don't think Putin is going to be that successful, because he's working with a relative weak economy, a resource-based economy. It's a one-resource-based economy. He doesn't have a lot of leverage there. Let the price of oil drop, which it will at some point in the next 5 years, and he'll be in trouble. But we've got in the interim, we've got to take seriously this buildup, including, by the way, doubling the forces that he's placed on the border with the Baltic states. He's doing now what he did 2 years ago in the western part of Russia. So we have to change his calculation on what kind of resistance he's likely to face if he does that.
Well, I'm so glad, especially with your background with President Reagan, that you brought up this issue of making sure that we're using energy, his vulnerabilities, our strengths at the moment as a weapon against this guy, is really part of a larger strategy, very much, I would like to think, like the one President Reagan did successfully employ, notably that one laid out in NSDD 75.
The most important thing, Frank, is that we re-energize this American economy and rebuild our defenses. I mean, this is where the current president, I think, has failed badly. He's allowed the foundations of our foreign policy to erode while he has expanded diplomatic activity everywhere.
Well, expanded it rather fecklessly, unfortunately, Henry. Now, he would do well to be taking counsel from you, as I hope your students are at the moment at the Elliott School of George Washington University. Thank you for your thoughts on both how conservative internationalism should be employed at the moment in the present crisis and your pedagogy to the next generation of practitioners. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. We'll be talking a little bit more about this energy weapon business, both it's being used against us and what we might do to wield it ourselves, with Gal Luft right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Andy McCarthy, one of the great champions of freedom in this war for the free world, a man whose contributions are almost too numerous to count. I won't go through all of them except to mention that he has served our country as a former federal prosecutor, but now is serving it in his capacity as a columnist for the NationalViewOnline.com and also for PJ Media. And I have had a sneak preview of an exceptionally important new book he's written called Faithless Execution, Building the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. We'll be talking more about that in the weeks to come. But I did want to just start off by saying, Andy, what you address exceedingly well in that book is something you've been talking about for many, many months now with me and others, including very recently in your piece this weekend on the clemency initiative the president has just unveiled, about really the full frontal assault on the rule of law by this president. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
I think, Frank, that the most important duty that a president has is to execute the laws. It's what the sort of by definition an executive does. And, you know, obviously for our areas of primary concern, most of the president's responsibilities other than that are in the national security area, and they're, of course, at least equally important. I don't mean to diminish them. But by definition, what we have an executive for is to execute the laws. And in our system, the division of responsibilities, which is really key to freedom, that is the system of separation of powers so that the particularly the executive and legislative powers aren't conjoined in a way that can breed tyranny, that's really the most important premise of a freedom-friendly system. I think Obama's presidency has been really an almost nonstop onslaught on that very idea, and most recently we see it in this gambit to, as I would say, rewrite the federal narcotics laws because the Obama administration philosophically disagrees with them, and it's the same sort of tactic we've seen in immigration. It's the same tactic we're seeing in with the EPA, with the various executive bureaucracies that Obama controls.
Right, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. One other, Andy, that has been of concern to us, we've discussed it from time to time, but I wanted to get back to it because of breaking events in Egypt, and that is the president's rewriting of the laws governing refugee status that have heretofore said if you've been engaged in material support for terrorism, you cannot get admitted under that status. He's now said, well, if you've just engaged in limited amounts of material support for terrorism, and that's not entirely clear what that is, maiming some, perhaps killing just a few, I don't know. But the point is that he's apparently opened the door for refugees to come in on that basis at the very moment that the Egyptian government is very, very assiduously cracking down on people who probably would benefit from that kind of relief, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about the rulings of capital crimes that have just been released, Andy, there, and what this might mean for an inflow of folks in this country who we don't want here.
There's been, I think, dozens of capital sentences have been imposed by the Egyptian courts, and they're ultimately not going to be upheld. I mean, you know, generally what happens in this system is, it takes a long time, but basically these cases now go to, first they have to be approved Islamically, and then they go to a court of appeals, and then, you know, ultimately what will happen is there will be some discount, and it's, half these people will be out quicker than a jaywalking sentence in the United States.
And the point is whether they will begin jaywalking in the United States among possibly other crimes.
That's exactly right, because even though we know that this is largely a charade, this idea of death sentences, it does ratchet up their ability to claim, asylum and fear of persecution and the like. Now, if they're in custody, it's not like the Egyptians are going to let them out. So that's at least let them out so that they can come here. But if they're not in custody, if they're like people who are tried in absentia, which is something that happens in Egypt as well, it increases the likelihood that the administration here, which has been very Muslim Brotherhood friendly, oddly, here's Egypt, the place where they know the Muslim Brotherhood the best, and they see what a pernicious outfit it is they're trying to stamp it out, that's when we here are opening our arms to it, which is kind of crazy on its own.
On many different grounds, as you've documented with the Grand Jihad and willful blindness and so on. Andy, let me turn to another topic that is indicative of some serious willful blindness, it would appear, and that is John Kerry's recent declaration, albeit to the very secretive and somewhat controversial trilateral commission, that Israel risks becoming an apartheid state. What do you make of that statement, for which he's now kind of apologized, sort of backtracked a lot? And more to the point, the preoccupation that it seems to reflect on one of the lesser problems that we're confronting in that part of the world at the moment.
Yeah, you know, I remember when I was a kid and I used to tell my parents that I was sorry about something I wasn't sorry for, and they'd tell me, "You're sorry you got caught." And, you know, I think that's where Kerry is at. I keep wanting to call him Senator Kerry.
For the good old days.
Yeah, for the good old days. But because he so distinguished himself there that he was certainly worthy of this promotion, if that's what it is. But
Peter Principle, if ever it operated.
Boy, oh boy. But, you know, I think the interesting thing about this, Frank, is twofold. One is that, you know, for all the backtracking and apologizing and all that jazz, and I don't really think what he's done is apologize, he really is speaking the Obama script. I mean, this is really the sort of thinking that we've seen from the administration from day one. So, I think that they're more upset that this has – that what they actually think has been shown in a stark way than anything else. And I also think that the amazing contrast here, and it really is amazing, is that about a week ago, the Palestinians – in the middle of Kerry's big peace push, announced that they're going to have a unity government between Fatah, which maintains its own anti-Israeli terrorist wing, and Hamas, which by charter is pledged to the destruction of Israel. So that's what the Palestinians think of the peace negotiations.
Sound like partners for peace to me.
That's right. The competition between the two is who wants to kill all the Israelis more, right? And what Kerry and Obama worried about is Israel becoming an apartheid state. I mean, how do you even wrap your brain around that? We have the peace partner is pledged to the destruction of the other guy, and what they're worried about is the only democracy in the Middle East
is trying to defend itself against these enemies. It would be hilarious if it were not so serious, unfortunately, Andy, and I appreciate you ruminating about it with us. Andy, just back on the other topic for one last moment. The freedom of speech is in jeopardy, it seems to me, from this administration in a number of different ways. You've chronicled many of them, including the president's stated belief that the future must not belong to, quote, those who slander the prophet of Islam, unquote. We've had a bit of a kerfuffle over whether those who are endlessly claiming to be offended by such slander will be allowed to rewrite the script for the 9/11 memorial film. Seems so far they're being resisted in that, but talk about that in the context of this larger problem we're discussing.
Well, you know, I think, Frank, if you could define the problem broadly, and what's going on at the 9/11 memorial is one iteration of a really broad problem. It is that, you know, the left's policies don't work in terms of effectiveness and in terms of improving our security or our lives. And rather than admit failure, what they try to do is redefine the world around them to comport with their fantasy version of what the world ought to look like. What that necessarily requires, if you're going to pull it off, is you have to suppress any other version of events, including reality. And what they're essentially trying to do, whether it's down at the 9/11 memorial, or it's on college campuses, or it's on Capitol Hill, or it's in our law, or on television, is suppress contrary views. Unfortunately, it's not going to make their fantasy version of the world any more real.
Andy McCarthy, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time. As always, it's great to talk with you. Congratulations on your new book, Faithless Execution. We can't wait to talk with you about it on air. We'll do so soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Gal Luft about, well, what is going on with energy security and how we can enhance ours and prevent others from diminishing it. Straight ahead.
listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the George Washington University's Elliott School, Dr. Henry Now. He is a man who served with distinction on President Reagan's National Security Council. He is the author, most recently, of Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan. It's always good to have him with us. Henry, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what a conservative internationalist would do about this Ukraine business. Vladimir Putin persists in ramping up, it seems, the pressure and perhaps is spoiling for a fight there. You've urged that NATO act sooner rather than later. Talk a little bit about how you see this conflict unfolding and what you would specifically would recommend we do now.
Right. Well, conservative internationalism advocates, Frank, using a little force early in order to avoid using a lot more force later. So in some sense, had we acted 2 or 3 years ago and used just a little bit of force to reassure Ukraine, we might have avoided both Crimea and what's taking place now in eastern Ukraine. Today, it's very difficult for us to do much other than to support the Kiev government. I would like to see us provide some more substantial military support, but we're behind the curve in Ukraine. My recent newspaper article suggested that we move now in the NATO countries that are next on Mr. Putin's list, and that we use a little bit of force now to station NATO troops in Poland, in Romania, in the Baltic states, so that when he, in a couple of years, when he moves against those countries, he will face a different calculus.
If it's a couple of years, indeed. And just very quickly to calibrate here, Henry, now, a little bit of force seems to be what President Obama has talked about. He's got 150 troops that he is stationed in these various countries or is engaging in exercises. I assume you've got something more than that in mind.
No, I think absolutely. I mean, we've now landed some 82nd Airborne troops in Poland. I mean, I think we should land a couple of thousand. We should position a couple of thousand troops.
We're visiting with Dr. Henry Now. He is the author of Conservative Internationalism, Armed Diplomacy Under Jefferson, Polk, Truman, and Reagan, and a professor at the Elliott School of George Washington University. And Henry, in terms of calibrating this properly, obviously part of this is a function of do we understand what we're up against? John Kerry, the Secretary of State, testified the other day before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and made it sound as though, once again, it's just really a problem that Putin doesn't understand the ways of the world, that he's not operating in the 21st century. You're a professor of these matters and understand them deeply. What do you make of that kind of comment by our Secretary of State?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, I mean, it's sad to say, but I wonder if Secretary Kerry isn't the one who's out of touch with reality. I mean, Russia is playing the same game that has always been played in international affairs, and it is still being played today. That is, he is taking advantage of weakness in order to expand his influence. He would like to reestablish that former Soviet sphere of influence. And we need to play the game of balancing the power, that is, of making it clear to him that it's going to cost him if he moves in this direction and eventually deter him from doing this. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't continue to do a lot of other things that are more 21st century. I think we should be offering the Russians all kinds of opportunities to participate productively in the global economy. They need foreign investment. So we should hold that out as a carrot. But at the same time, we have to be very clear about limiting any kind of territorial expansion, which is as real today, by the way, as in the 19th century. We can see that in the Far East as well with China.
Indeed. And that's perhaps a subject for another day's conversation. But just staying with the present one, and again, we're speaking with Dr. Henry Now, who wrote recently at dw.de, NATO should act now, not later. Let me ask you, Henry, now, as a former international economic affairs, sort of official in the National Security Council under President Reagan, what you make of the concern that is being expressed by some that Putin may respond to the ratcheting up of these sanctions. I gather this is now the fourth round in sort of small increments that have implicated more and more of his cronies and some of the companies they're associated with. But what about the prospect that he may retaliate by accelerating his own effort to take down the dollar as the reserve currency? Should we be concerned about that, and what should we be doing about it?
I don't think so, because he will take down his own economy if he does that. And this is the same issue, you know, that we face with China. Yes, both Russia and China could start selling their dollar reserves, foreign exchange reserves. But if they do that, it means that they're going to be able to export less oil in the case of Russia, or less goods in the case of China. I mean, this is a bargain that has worked very well for all sides. And I don't think they'll do that. Now, they'll potentially threaten to do that, or at least make us worry about doing that. I think we should, continue to tighten the sanctions, but more importantly, we should make some military moves. This is what Mr. Putin will understand. If we station some troops now, NATO troops permanently, I think we should set up some NATO bases in some of these bordering countries. We by the way, agreed not to do that in 1997 in order to appease the Russians. Well, they've now violated that agreement, and we should make it clear to them that we intend to put, 2,000, 2,500 small forces, but they're going to be permanently based there. That will affect his thinking, I think, a lot more than the, as you say, very incremental sanctions that we've been imposing against some of his cronies.
Yeah, so much of this, it seems to me, Henry, now requires the authority of military capability behind whatever diplomacy we're engaged in. And you've made the point in your article about the very substantial buildup that Putin has engaged in recent years, increasing by 79% over the past decade, his military spending, and an almost 50% increase expected in the next 3 years. Talk a little bit about how the failure on our side to be doing that not only impinges upon our ability to put forces in places like this that we need, but to really back it up with the credible threat behind it.
He has been expanding his power base and principally on the strength, of course, of high oil prices. On that basis, however, he's been expanding both the economic activity in Russia. They've had reasonable economic growth over recent years. And, of course, he's been funding this massive buildup in military capabilities. Now, he's taking a page from Ronald Reagan, who in the early 80s, built up dramatically the economic and military foundations of American foreign policy. And that had a tremendous influence over our ability to eventually bring an end to the Cold War. Now, I don't think Putin is going to be that successful because he's working with a relatively weak economy, a resource-based economy. It's a one-resource-based economy. He doesn't have a lot of leverage there. Let the price of oil drop, which it will at some point in the next 5 years, and he'll be in trouble. But we've got, in the interim, we've got to take seriously this buildup, including, by the way, doubling the forces that he's placed on the border with the Baltic states. He's doing now what he did 2 years ago in the western part of Russia. So we have to change his calculation on what kind of resistance he's likely to face if he does that.
Well, I'm so glad, especially with your background with President Reagan, that you brought up this issue of making sure that we're using energy, his vulnerabilities, our strengths at the moment as a weapon against this guy, is really part of a larger strategy, very much, I would like to think, like the one President Reagan did successfully employ, notably that one laid out in NSDD 75.
The most important thing, Frank, is that we re-energize this American economy and rebuild our defenses. I mean, this is where the current president, I think, has failed badly. He's allowed the foundations of our foreign policy to erode while he has expanded diplomatic activity everywhere.
Well, expanded it rather fecklessly, unfortunately, Henry. Now, he would do well to be taking counsel from you, as I hope your students are at the moment at the Elliott School of George Washington University. Thank you for your thoughts on both how conservative internationalism should be employed at the moment in the present crisis and your pedagogy to the next generation of practitioners. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. We'll be talking a little bit more about this energy weapon business, both it's being used against us and what we might do to wield it ourselves, with Gal Luft right after this.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.